Star Wars, Dark Force Rising by Timothy Zahn. Continued. Cassette number 5, side 1. Then, with a sigh, she bowed her head slightly.
Come with me, Kabarak said to Leia, brushing past her and Chewbacca to the door. The Maethrak has agreed to hide you from our lord the Grand Admiral, at least for now.
Where are we going? Leia asked, as they followed him out into the night.
Your droid and your analysis equipment I will hide among the decon droids that are stored for the night in an outer shed, the Nogri explained, pointing to a windowless building 50 meters away. You and the Wookiee will be more of a problem. If the Imperials have sensor equipment with him, your life sign profiles will register as different from Nogri.
I know, Leia said, searching the sky for the shuttle's running lights and trying to remember everything she could about life form identification algorithms. Heart rate was one of the parameters she knew, as were ambient atmosphere, respiratory byproducts, and molecule chain EM polarization effects. But the chief long-range parameter was... We need a heat source, she told Kabarak. As big a one as possible.
The bakehouse, the Nogri said, pointing to a windowless building 3 down from where they stood.
At its back was a squat chimney from which wisps of smoke could be seen curling upward in the backwash of light from the surrounding structures. Sounds like our best chance, Leia agreed. Kabarak, you hide 3PO. Chewie, come with me.
The Nogri were waiting for them as they stepped from the shuttle, 3 females standing side by side, with 2 children acting as honor wardens by the doors of the Clan Dooka building. Thrawn glanced at the group, threw an evaluating sweep around the area, and then turned to Pelion.
Wait here until the tech team arrives, Captain, he ordered Pelion quietly. Get them started on a check of the communications and countermeasures equipment in the ship over there. Then join me inside.
Yes, sir.
Thrawn turned to Irheim.
Dynast, he invited, gesturing at the waiting Nogri.
The Dynast bowed and strode toward them. Thrawn threw a glance at Ruch, who'd taken Irheim's former position at the Grand Admiral's side, and together they followed. There was the usual welcoming ritual, and then the females led the way into the Dooka. The shuttle from the Chimera was only a couple of minutes behind them. Pelion briefed the tech team and got them busy, then crossed to the Dooka and went in. He'd expected that the Maitrak would have managed to round up perhaps a handful of her people for this impromptu late-evening visit by their glorious lord and master. To his surprise, he found that the old girl had, in fact, turned out half the village. There was a double row of them, children as well as adults, lining the Dooka walls from the huge genealogy wall chart back to the double doors and around again to the meditation booth opposite the chart. Thrawn was seated in the clan high seat, 2/3 of the way to the back of the room, with Irheim standing again at his side. The 3 females who'd met the shuttle stood facing them, with a second tier of elders another pace back. Standing with the females, his steel-gray skin a marked contrast to their older, darker gray, was a young Nogri male. Pelion had apparently missed nothing more important than a smattering of the nonsense ritual the Nogris never seemed to get enough of. As he moved past the silent lines of aliens to stand at Thrawn's other side, the young male stepped forward and knelt before the high seat.
I greet you, my lord, he mewed gravely, spreading his arms out to his sides. You honor my family and the clan Kimbar with your presence here.
You may rise, Thrawn told him. You are Kabarak, clan Kimbar.
I am, my lord.
You were once a member of the Imperial Nogri Commando Team 22, Thrawn said. A team that ceased to exist on the planet Kashyyyk. Tell me what happened.
Kabarak might have twitched. Pelion couldn't tell for sure.
I filed a report, my lord, immediately upon leaving that world.
Yes, I read the report, Thrawn told him coolly. Read it very carefully, and noticed the questions it left unanswered. Such as how and why you survived when all others in your team were killed, and how it was you were able to escape when the entire planet had been alerted to your presence, and why you did not return immediately to either Honor or one of our other bases after your failure.
This time there was definitely a twitch, possibly a reaction to the word failure.
I was left unconscious by the Wookiees during the first attack, Kabarak said. I awakened alone and made my way back to the ship. Once there, I deduced what had happened to the rest of the team from official information sources. I suspect they simply were unprepared for the speed and stealth of my ship when I made my escape. As to my whereabouts afterward, my lord, he hesitated. I transmitted my report and then left for a time to be alone.
Why?
To think, my lord, and to meditate.
Wouldn't Honor have been a more suitable place for such meditation? Thrawn asked, waving a hand around the Dooka.
I had much to think about, my lord.
For a moment, Thrawn eyed him thoughtfully.
You were slow to respond when the request for a recognition signal came from the surface, he said. You then refused to land at the N'Stau port facilities.
I did not refuse, my lord. I was never ordered to land there.
The distinction is noted, Thrawn said dryly. Tell me why you chose to come here instead.
I wished to speak with my Matrix, to discuss my meditations with her, and to ask forgiveness for my failure.
And have you done so? Thrawn asked, turning to face the Matrix.
We have begun, she said in atrociously mangled basic. We have not finished.
At the back of the room, the Dooka doors swung open, and one of the tech team stepped inside.
You have a report, Denson, Thrawn called to him.
Yes, Admiral, the other said, crossing the room and stepping somewhat gingerly around the assembled group of Nogri elders. We've finished our preliminary set of comm and countermeasures tests, sir, as per orders.
Thrawn shifted his gaze to Kabarak.
And?
We think we've located the malfunction, sir. The main transmitter coil seems to have overloaded and backfed into a dump capacitor, damaging several nearby circuits. The compensator computer rebuilt the pathway, but the bypass was close enough to one of the static damping command lines for the resulting inductance surge to trigger it.
An interesting set of coincidences, Thrawn said, his glowing eyes still on Kabarak. A natural malfunction, do you think? Or an artificial one.
The Matrox stirred as if about to say something. Thrawn looked at her and she subsided.
Impossible to say, sir, the tech said, choosing his words carefully.
Obviously, he hadn't missed the fact that this was skating him close to the edge of insult in the middle of a group of Nogri who might decide to take offense at it. Someone who knew what he was doing could probably have pulled it off. I have to say, though, sir, that compensator computers in general have a pretty low reputation among mechanics. They're okay on the really serious stuff that can get unskilled pilots into big trouble. But on non-critical reroutes like this, they've always had a tendency to foul up something else along the way.
Thank you.
If Thrawn was annoyed that he hadn't caught Kabarak red-handed in a lie, it didn't show in his face.
Your team will take the ship back to N'Stau for repairs.
Yes, sir.
The tech saluted and left. Thrawn looked back at Kabarak.
With your team destroyed, you will, of course, have to be reassigned, he said. When your ship has been repaired, you will fly it to the Valrar base in Glyth Sector and report there for duty.
Yes, my lord, Kabarak said.
Thrawn stood up. You have much to be proud of here, he said, inclining his head slightly to the Maitrach. Your family's service to the Clan Kimbar and to the Empire will be long remembered by all of honor.
As will your leadership and protection of the Nogri people, the Maitrach responded.
Flanked by Ruch and Yechaim, Thrawn stepped down from the chair and headed back toward the double doors. Pelion took up the rear, and a minute later they were once again out in the chilly night air. The shuttle was standing ready, and without further comment or ritual, Thrawn led the way inside. As they lifted, Pelion caught just a glimpse out the viewport of the Nogri filing out of the Dukat to watch their departing leaders.
Well, that was pleasant, he muttered under his breath.
Thrawn looked at him. A waste of time, you think, Captain? He asked mildly. Pelion glanced at Yechaim, seated farther toward the front of the shuttle. The Dynast didn't seem to be listening to them, but it would probably still pay to be tactful.
Diplomatically, sir, I am sure it was worthwhile to demonstrate that you care about all of honor, including the outer villages, he told Thrawn. Given that the commando ship really had malfunctioned, I don't think anything else was gained.
Thrawn turned to stare out the side viewport. I'm not so sure of that, Captain, he said. There's something not quite right back there. Ruch, what's your reading of our young commando, Kabarak?
He was unsettled, the bodyguard told him quietly. That much I saw in his hands and his face.
Yechaim swiveled around in his chair.
It is a naturally unsettling experience to face the Lord of the Nogri, he said.
Particularly when one's hands are wet with failure, Rook countered.
Yechaim half rose from his seat, and for a pair of heartbeats, the air between the two Nogri was thick with tension.
Pelion felt himself pressing back in his seat cushions, the long and bloody history of Nogri clan rivalry flooding fresh into his consciousness.
This mission has generated several failures, Thrawn said calmly into the taut silence. In that, the clan Kimbar hardly stands alone.
Slowly, Yechaim resumed his seat.
Kabarak is still young, he said.
He is, indeed, Thrawn agreed. One reason, I presume, why he's such a bad liar. Ruch, perhaps the Dynast Yechaim would enjoy the view from the forward section. Please escort him there.
Yes, my lord.
Ruch stood up. Dynast Yechaim, he said, gesturing toward the forward blast door. For a moment, the other Nogri didn't move. Then, with obvious reluctance, he stood up. My lord, he said stiffly, and headed down the aisle. Thrawn waited until the door had closed on both aliens before turning back to Pelion.
Kabarak is hiding something, Captain, he said, a cold fire in his eyes. I'm certain of it.
Yes, sir, Pelion said, wondering how the Grand Admiral had come to that conclusion. Certainly the routine sensor scan they'd just run hadn't picked up anything. Shall I order a sensor focus on the village?
That's not what I meant, Thrawn shook his head. He wouldn't have brought anything incriminating back to honor with him. You can't hide anything for long in one of these close-knit villages. No, it's something he's not telling us about that missing month, the one where he claims he was off meditating by himself.
We might be able to learn something from his ship, Pelion suggested.
Agreed, Thrawn nodded. Have a scanning crew go over it before the techs get to work. Every cubic millimeter of it,
interior and exterior both. And have surveillance put someone on Kabarak.
Yes, sir, Pelion said. One of our people or another Nogri.
Thrawn cocked an eyebrow at him. The ridiculously obvious or the heavily political, in other words, he asked dryly. Yes, you're right, of course. Let's try a third option. Does the Chimera carry any espionage droids?
I don't believe so, sir, Pelion said, punching up the question on the shuttle's computer link. No. We have some Arakeed Viper probe droids, but nothing of the more compact espionage class.
Then we'll have to improvise, Thrawn said. Have engineering put a Viper motivator into a decon droid and rig it with full-range optical and auditory sensors and a recorder. We'll have it put in with the group working out of Kabarak's village.
Yes, sir, Pelion said, keying in the order. Do you want a transmitter installed, too?
Thrawn shook his head. No, a recorder should be sufficient. The antenna would be difficult to conceal from view. The last thing we want is for some curious Nogri to see it and wonder why this one was different.
Pelion nodded his understanding. Especially since that might lead the aliens to start pulling decon droids apart for a look inside.
Yes, sir. I'll have the order placed right away.
Thrawn's glowing eyes shifted to look out the viewport.
There's no particular rush here, he said thoughtfully. Not now. This is the calm before the storm, Captain. And until the storm is ready to unleash, we might as well spend our time and energy making sure our illustrious Jedi Master will be willing to assist us when we want him.
Which means bringing Leia Organa Solo to him.
Exactly.
Thrawn looked at the forward blast door.
And if my presence is what the Nogri need to inspire them, then my presence is what they'll have.
For how long? Pelion asked. Thrawn smiled tightly.
For as long as it takes.
Chapter 11.
Han, Lando's voice came from the cabin intercom beside the bunk. Wake up.
Yeah, I'm awake, Han grunted, swiping at his eyes with one hand and swiveling the repeater displays toward him with the other.
If there was one thing his years on the wrong side of the law had hammered into him, it was the knack of going from deep sleep to full alertness in the space between heartbeats.
What's up?
We're here, Lando announced. Wherever here is.
I'll be right up.
They were in sight of their target planet by the time he dressed and made his way to the Lady Lux cockpit.
Where's Irines?
He asked, peering out at the mottled blue-green crescent shape they were rapidly approaching. It looked pretty much like any of a thousand other planets he'd seen.
She's gone back to the aft control station, Lando told him. I got the impression she wanted to be able to send down some recognition codes without us looking over her shoulder.
Any idea where we are?
Not really, Lando said. Transit time was 47 hours, but that doesn't tell us a whole lot.
Han nodded, searching his memory. A dreadnought can pull, what, about 0.4?
About that, Lando agreed. When it's really in a hurry, anyway.
Means we aren't any more than 150 light-years from New Cove, then.
I guess we're closer than that myself, Lando said. It wouldn't make much sense to use New Cove as a contact point if they were that far away.
Unless New Cove was Brelia's idea and not theirs, Han pointed out.
Possible, Lando said. I still think we're closer than 150 light-years, though. They could have taken their time getting here just to mislead us.
Han looked up at the dreadnought that had been hauling them through hyperspace for the past 2 days. Or to have time to organize a reception committee.
There's that,
Lando nodded. I don't know if I mentioned it, but after they apologized for getting the magnetic coupling off-center over our hatch, I went back and took a look.
You didn't mention it, but I did the same thing, Anne said sourly. Looked kind of deliberate, didn't it?
That's what I thought, too, Lando said. Like maybe they wanted an excuse to keep us cooped up down here and not wandering around their ship.
Could be lots of good and innocent reasons for that, Anne reminded him.
And lots of not-so-innocent ones, Lando countered. You sure you don't have any idea who this commander of theirs might be?
Not even a guess. Probably be finding out real soon, though.
The comm crackled on.
Lady Luck, this is Sena, a familiar voice said. We've arrived.
Yes, we noticed, Lando told her. I expect you'll want us to follow you down.
Right, she said. The Peregrine will drop the magnetic coupling whenever you're ready to fly.
Han stared at the speaker, barely hearing Lando's response.
A ship called the Peregrine?
You still with me?
Han focused on Lando, noticing with mild surprise that the other's conversation with Sena had ended.
Yeah, he said. Sure. It's just that name, Peregrine, rang an old bell.
You've heard of it?
Not the ship, no, Anne shook his head. The Peregrine was an old Corellian scare legend they used to tell when I was a kid. He was some old ghostly guy who'd been cursed to wander around the world forever and never find his home again. Used to make me feel real creepy.
From above came a clang, and with a jolt, they were free of the dreadnought. Lando eased them away from the huge warship, looking up as it passed by overhead.
Well, try to remember it was just a legend, he reminded Han.
Han looked at the dreadnought.
Sure, he said, a little too quickly. I know that.
They followed Sena's freighter down and were soon skimming over what appeared to be a large grassy plain dotted with patches of stubby coniferous trees. A wall of craggy cliffs loomed directly ahead. An ideal spot, Han's old smuggler instincts told him, to hide a spaceship support and servicing base. A few minutes later, his hunch was borne out as, sweeping over a low ridge, they came to the encampment. An encampment that was far too large to be merely a servicing base. Rows upon rows of camouflaged structures filled the plain just beneath the cliffs. Everything from small living quarters to larger admin and supply sheds to still larger maintenance and tool buildings, up to a huge camo-roofed refurbishing hangar. The perimeter was dotted with the squat turret-topped cylinders of Golan Arms anti-infantry batteries and a few of the longer Spizak anti-vehicle weapons, along with some KAAC free-runner assault vehicles parked in defensive posture. Lando whistled softly under his breath.
Would you look at that, he said. What is this, someone's private army?
Looks that way, Anne agreed, feeling the skin on the back of his neck starting to crawl. He'd run into private armies before, and they'd never been anything but trouble.
I think I'm starting not to like this, Lando decided, easing the Lady Luck gingerly over the outer sentry line.
Ahead, Sena's freighter was approaching a landing pad, barely visible against the rest of the ground.
You sure you want to go through with this?
What? With three dreadnoughts standing on our heads out there? Han snorted. I don't think we've got a whole lot of choice. Not in this crate, anyway.
Probably right, Lando conceded, apparently too preoccupied to notice the insult to his ship. So, what do we do?
Sena's freighter had dropped its landing skids and was settling onto the pad.
I guess we go down and behave like invited guests, Han said.
Lando nodded at Han's blaster.
You don't think they'll object to their invited guests coming in armed?
Let 'em object first, Han said grimly.
Then we'll discuss it. Lando put the Lady Luck down beside the freighter, and together he and Han made their way to the aft hatchway. Irenes, her transmission chores finished, was waiting there for them, her own blaster strapped prominently to her hip. A transport skiff was parked outside, and as the three of them headed down the ramp, Sena and a handful of her entourage came around the Lady Luck's bow. Most of the others were dressed in a casual tan uniform of an unfamiliar but vaguely Corellian cut. Sena, by contrast, was still in the nondescript civilian garb she'd been wearing on New Cove. "Welcome to our base of operations," Sena said, waving a hand to encompass the encampment around them. "If you'll come with us, the commander is waiting to meet you." "Busy-looking place you've got here," Han commented as they all boarded the skiff. "You getting ready to start a war or something?" "We're not in the business of starting wars," Sena said coolly. "Ah," Han nodded, looking around as the driver swung the skiff around and headed off through the camp. There was something about the layout that seemed vaguely familiar. Lando got it first. "You know, this place looks a lot like one of the old Alliance bases we used to work out of," he commented to Sena, "only built on the surface instead of dug in underground." "It does look that way, doesn't it?" Sena agreed, her voice not giving anything away. "You've had dealings with the Alliance, then?" Lando probed gently. Sena didn't answer. Lando looked at Han, eyebrows raised. Han shrugged slightly in return. Whatever was going on here, it was clear the hired hands weren't in the habit of talking about it. The skiff came to a halt beside an admin-type building, indistinguishable from the others nearby, except for the two uniformed guards flanking the doorway. They saluted as Sena approached, one of them reaching over to pull the door open. "The commander asked to see you for a moment alone, Captain Solo," Sena said, stopping by the open door. "We'll wait out here with General Calrissian." "Right," Han said. Taking a deep breath, he stepped inside. From its outside appearance, he'd expected it to be a standard administrative center with an outer reception area and a honeycomb of comfy executive offices stacked behind it. To his mild surprise, he found himself instead in a fully equipped war room. Lining the walls were comm and tracking consoles, including at least one crystal grav field trap receptor and what looked like the ranging control for a KDY V-150 Planet Defender ion cannon, like the one the Alliance had had to abandon on Hoth. In the center of the room, a large holo display showed a sector's worth of stars, with 100 multicolored markers and vector lines scattered among the glittering white dots. And standing beside the holo was a man. His face was distorted somewhat by the strangely colored lights playing on it from the display, and it was, at any rate, a face Han had never seen except in pictures. But even so, recognition came with the sudden jolt of an overhead thunderclap. "Senator Bel Iblis," he breathed. "Welcome to Peregrine's Nest, Captain Solo," the other said gravely, coming away from the holo toward him. "I'm flattered you still remember me." "It'd be hard for any Corellian to forget you, sir," Han said, his numbed brain noting vaguely in passing that there were very few people in the galaxy who rated an automatic sir from him. "But you were dead," Bel Iblis suggested, a half-smile creasing his lined face. "Well, yes," Han floundered. "I mean, everyone thought you died on Anchoron." "In a very real sense, I did," the other said quietly, the smile fading from his face. Closer now, Han was struck with just how lined with age and stress the senator's face was. "The Emperor wasn't quite able to kill me at Anchoron, but he might just as well have done so. He took everything I had except my life, my family, my profession, even all future contacts with mainstream Corellian society.
He forced me outside the law I'd worked so hard to create and maintain. The smile returned, like a hint of sunshine around the edge of a dark cloud. Forced me to become a rebel. I imagine you understand the feeling.
Pretty well, yeah, Anne said, grinning lopsidedly in return.
He'd read in school about the legendary presence of the equally legendary Senator Garm Bel-Iblis. Now he was getting to see that charm up close. It made him feel like a school kid again. I still can't believe this. I wish we'd known sooner. We could really have used this army of yours during the war.
For just a second, a shadow seemed to cross Bel-Iblis's face. We probably couldn't have done much to help, he said. It's taken us a good deal of time to build up to what you see here.
His smile returned. But there'll be time to talk about that later. Right now, I see you standing there trying to figure out exactly when it was we met. Actually, Hand had forgotten about Sena's references to a previous meeting. Tell you the truth, I haven't got a clue, he confessed. Unless it was after Ankaron and you were in disguise or something.
Bel-Iblis shook his head.
No disguise, but it wasn't something I'd really expect you to remember. I'll give you a hint. You were all of 11 at the time.
Han blinked.
11? He echoed. You mean in school?
Correct, Bel-Iblis nodded. Literally correct, in fact. It was at a convocation at your school, where you were being forced to listen to a group of us old fossils talk about politics.
Han felt his face warming. The specific memory was still a blank, but that was how he'd felt about politicians at that time in his life. Though, come to think of it, the opinion hadn't changed all that much over the years.
I'm sorry, but I still don't remember.
As I said, I didn't expect you to, Bel-Iblis said. I, on the other hand, remember the incident quite well. During the question period after the talk, you asked two irreverently phrased yet highly pointed questions. The first, regarding the ethics of the anti-alien bias starting to creep into the legal structure of the Republic. The second, about some very specific instances of corruption involving my colleagues in the Senate.
It was starting to come back, at least in a vague sort of way.
Yeah, I remember now, Han said slowly. I think one of my friends dared me to throw those questions at you. He probably figured I'd get in trouble for not being polite. I was in trouble enough that it didn't bother me.
Setting your life pattern early, were you? Bel-Iblis suggested dryly.
At any rate, they weren't the sort of questions I would have expected from an 11-year-old, and they intrigued me enough to ask about you. I've been keeping a somewhat loose eye on you ever since.
Han grimaced.
You probably weren't very impressed by what you saw. There were times, Bel-Iblis agreed. I'll admit to having been extremely disappointed when you were dismissed from the Imperial Academy. You'd shown considerable promise there, and I felt at the time that a strongly loyal officer corps was one of the few defenses the Republic still had left against the collapse toward Empire.
He shrugged.
Under the circumstances, it's just as well that you got out when you did. With your obvious disdain for authority, you'd have been quietly eliminated in the Emperor's purge of those officers he hadn't been able to seduce to his side. And then things would have gone quite differently, wouldn't they?
Maybe a little, Anne conceded modestly.
He glanced around the war room. So how long have you been here at, you called it, Peregrine's Nest?
Oh, we never stay anywhere for very long, Bel-Iblis said, clapping a hand on Han's shoulder and gently but firmly turning him toward the door.
Sit still too long and the Imperials will eventually find you, but we can talk business later. Right now, your friend outside is probably getting nervous. Come introduce me to him.
Lando was indeed looking a little tense as Han and Bel-Iblis stepped out into the sunlight again.
It's all right,
Han assured him. We're with friends. Senator, this is Lando Calrissian, one-time general of the Rebel Alliance. Lando, Senator Garm Bel-Iblis. He hadn't expected Lando to recognize the name of a long-past Corellian politician. He was right. Senator Bel-Iblis, Lando nodded, his voice neutral. Honored to meet you, General Calrissian, Bel-Iblis said. I've heard a great deal about you. Lando glanced at Han. Just Calrissian, he said. The general is more a courtesy title now. Then we're even, Bel-Iblis smiled. I'm not a senator anymore, either. He waved a hand at Sena. You've met my chief advisor and unofficial ambassador at large, Sena Lykvold Midanyil. And, he paused, looking around. I understood Irenis was with you. She was needed back at the ship, sir, Sena told him. Our other guest required some soothing. Yes, Council Aid Brelia, Bel-Iblis said, glancing in the direction of the landing pad. This could prove somewhat awkward. Yes, sir, Sena said. Perhaps I shouldn't have brought him here, but at the time I didn't see any other reasonable course of action. Oh, I agree, Bel-Iblis assured her. Leaving him in the middle of an imperial raid would have been more than simply awkward. Han felt a slight chill run through him. In the flush of excitement over meeting Bel-Iblis, he'd completely forgotten what had taken them to New Cove in the first place. You seem to be on good terms with Brelia, Senator, he said carefully. Bel-Iblis eyed him. And you'd like to know just what those good terms entail. Han steeled himself. As a matter of fact, sir, yes, I would. The other smiled slightly. You still have that underlying refusal to flinch before authority, don't you? Good. Come on over to the headquarters lounge, and I'll tell you anything you want to know. His smile hardened just a little. And after that, I'll have some questions to ask you as well. The door slid open, and Pelion stepped into the darkened antechamber of Thrawn's private command room. Darkened and apparently empty. But Pelion knew better than that. I have important information for the Grand Admiral, he said loudly. I don't have time for these little games of yours. They are not games, Rook's gravelly voice mewed right in Pelion's ear, making him jump despite his best efforts not to. Stalking skills must be practiced or lost. Practice on someone else, Pelion growled. I have work to do. He stepped forward to the inner door, silently cursing Rook and the whole Nogri race. Useful tools of the Empire they might well be, but he'd dealt with this kind of close-knit clan structure before, and he'd never found such primitives to be anything but trouble in the long run. The door to the command room slid open, revealing a darkness lit only by softly glowing candles. Pelion stopped abruptly, his mind flashing back to that eerie crypt on Wayland, where 1,000 candles marked the graves of off-worlders who had come there over the past few years, only to be slaughtered by Jorus Kabauth. For Thrawn to have turned his command room into a duplicate of that. No, I haven't come under the influence of our unstable Jedi Master. Thrawn's voice came dryly across the room. Over the candles, Pelion could just see the Grand Admiral's glowing red eyes. Look closer. Pelion did as instructed, to discover that the candles were in fact holographic images of exquisitely delicate lighted sculptures. Beautiful, aren't they? Thrawn said, his voice meditative. They're Corellian flame miniatures, one of that very short list of art forms which others have tried to copy, but never truly been able to duplicate. Nothing more than shaped transoptical fibers, pseudo-luminescent plant material,
and a pair of ghoulish light sources, really. And yet, somehow, there's something about them that's never been captured by anyone else. The holographic flames faded away, and in the center of the room, a frozen image of three dreadnought cruisers appeared. "This was taken by the Relentless 2 days ago off the planet New Cove, Captain," Thrawn continued in the same thoughtful tone. "Watch closely." He started the recording. Pelion watched in silence as the dreadnoughts in triangular formation opened fire with ion cannons toward the camera's point of view. Almost hidden in the fury of the assault, a freighter and what looked like a small pleasure yacht could be seen skittering to safety down the middle of the formation. Still firing, the dreadnoughts began drawing back, and a minute later, the whole group had jumped to light speed. The holo faded away, and the room lights came up to a gentle glow. "Comments?" Thrawn invited. "Looks like our old friends are back," Pelion said. "They seem to have recovered from that scare we gave them at Lenuri. A nuisance, especially right now."
"Unfortunately, indications are that they are about to become more than just a nuisance," Thrawn told him. "One of the two ships they were rescuing was identified by the Relentless as the Lady Luck, with Han Solo and Lando Calrissian aboard."
Pelion frowned. "Solo and Calrissian? But..." He broke off sharply.
"But they were supposed to go to the Palanti system," Thrawn finished for him. "Yes, an error on my part. Obviously, something more important came up than their concerns for Akbar's reputation."
Pelion looked back at where the holo had been. "Such as adding new strength to the rebellion military."
"I don't believe they've merged quite yet," Thrawn said, his forehead furrowed with thought. "Nor do I believe such an alliance is inevitable. That was a Corellian leading that task force, Captain. I'm sure of that now."
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.